You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people, the places, and the pomp of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
It's a wonderful night for Oscar.
Oscar, Oscar.
Who will win?
Win.
The nominees for Best Picture are...
Yes, they're rolling out the red carpet at the Dolby Theater. And this year at downtown's Union Station for those heavy golden statuettes. Years now into a coordinated campaign to diversify the pool of nominees and their movies, there are people of color up for awards in the acting, directing, and producing categories. But what about the so-called below-the-line jobs? The hairdressers, set decorators, camera operators, gaffers, grips, art directors... There are a whole lot more people working below the line than end up on that marquee. Well, way back in 1969, the federal government got involved. The EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, held hearings here in Los Angeles and found that women and minorities were being discriminated against, and it recommended the Justice Department file suit. Well, the studios obviously didn't want any of that, so they agreed to diversify their workforce voluntarily. And joining us now are three people who've enjoyed successful Hollywood careers as a result of that. And I'm going to bring them all on now. Norm Langley is a retired camera operator. Cheryl Kearney is a retired set decorator. And Robert Stevenson is a retired hairdresser. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, Norm, I'm going to start with you. Did the studios just one day, after the threat of being sued, just go out and hire people of color and women? I mean, were there people in the workforce to even choose from?
Well, yeah, I'm sure there were people in the workforce, but not any to mention. They had to get a certain percentage that they were trying to reach a goal of, I think, 10%, which they, of course, didn't have then, and they still didn't have it once I got in. But no, I heard it from a cousin who worked in the industry that they were hiring or they were seeking people to get hired in Hollywood. And I put an application in, and I went before a review board and was selected. Now, the great thing about the program is that you would go to all the different studios in two-month intervals, learn their cameras, learn their paperwork, learn how to load magazines for the different cameras they had, and then eventually go out on stage and really do some hands-on work with the crews. And that year, I went to Universal, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Disney, MGM, and 20th Century Fox.
Wow, yeah.
So that when I was hired by Universal, I went right in as a second assistant, and I knew their cameras, I knew how to do the paperwork, I knew how to unload and load films, so I came out the gate running.
Robert, had the studios not been, you know, had this threat held over their head and said, you know, the EEOC saying, we're going to sue you, do you think... they would have just automatically done the right thing at some point?
I don't think so. But what they did do, they actually advertised on radio. And actually, that's how I heard it. I was in my salon getting ready to go to lunch, and I heard if you wanted to be in the film industry as props, or they had all the jobs, hairstylists, makeup artists, and all, come to the Dart Building on 3rd in La Cienega. I took off right away. And actually, it worked for me. I got a call at Universal, and they asked me, did I want to work in makeup, the makeup department? And I said, yes, I'm a hairstylist. They said, so we'll take you down and get you an interview. And they asked me a lot of questions. First thing they asked me, did I do white hair? that was one of the things that you had to be able to do, I guess, because there were no black actors and actresses. It wasn't that many. It was a few, but it wasn't that many.
What year was this?
This was 1969 and 70.
Yeah, that was about the time that Sidney Poitier won the Best Actor Oscar, right?
Yes, for Lilies of the Field.
Let's hear a little bit of his acceptance speech right here.
It is a long journey to this moment. I am naturally indebted to countless numbers of people. For all of them, all I can say is a very special thank you.
You go from Hattie McDaniel, who won Supporting Actress in 1940. She couldn't even sit in the hotel lounge, the Coconut Grove at the Ambassador Hotel. They had to call in a favor to get her in there so she could win this award. And then, you know, 30 some odd years later, after that, you got Sidney Poitier winning Best Actor, a lead role. You know, it seems like things are opening up a little bit for people of color. And Cheryl, I want to bring you in. You first started in this program around that time. Was there a lot of training, or did you, you know, was there just a job for you there? Did you hear it the same way as Robert and Norm heard it?
Well, I was in the same training program the first year. I trained at Paramount, Warner Brothers, 20th Century Fox, and CBS Studio Center. And at the end of the program, we had to get our own job at that point. So with being at CBS, they got me a job initially in the beginning. And so then I had to, you know, keep trying after that. And finally, foot gets totally in the door, and it works out fine. And it's been a good business, you know.
Your foot was in the door, and here we are talking about it. Norm, you were a camera operator, obviously an important job when it comes to the look of a film or a TV show. I mean, what kind of reaction did you get from people on the set when you first started doing this work, you know, in the early 1970s when there weren't a whole lot of people of color doing those kinds of jobs?
Well, I started out as a loader, you know, after the training program, and then I went to a second assistant. But no, they didn't really accept me on the sets because they figured I'm taking a job of maybe one of their brothers or sisters or cousins, because that nepotism was still going full bore in there. So for me, it was difficult, but I was not going to be deterred because this is what I had trained in the Navy and after I got out in college, and that's what I wanted to do. So when I got in, I just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. They kept pushing and pushing back, and eventually we came to a meeting of the minds that they're not going to get rid of me, and I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing, you know. And it took a while, but it never really went away, because there's always somebody that couldn't figure out how I was where I was and why they couldn't have gotten there.
Exactly, which is, I agree.
The white folks. And they just had their prejudice and the racism and everything else built in. That's why it took so long to have the program in the beginning, in the early 70s. So it was a constant battle. Sometimes it wasn't as much, and other times it would rear its ugly head. But I had more positive experience than negative. But you have to be able to just be in touch with what's happening around you and the people that you're dealing with and move on.
Robert, is it still like that today, do you suppose?
You know, it's changing. It's changing a lot. But like when I first came in, like, I only worked at Universal. Once they assigned me to Universal, I went into their makeup department and I worked there constantly. So I didn't have many problems because I became one of theirs once they trained me. But if I went to a show, they still wanted to kind of like, okay, can you do what we want? Although I could, and probably better than them. But the point is, I'm the outsider. You know, if they had a black actress or a black actor, they, of course, they would send me to that person because they didn't know how or they didn't want to. And then eventually I could also do white, so they could use me, you know, like a double-edged sword. I could go either way with them. But I worked for like 2 or 3 years before I ever got into the union because the union didn't want us in there.
I can't wrap my head around, can you do white hair? How did that even fly? I mean, were you upset about that or when they asked you that?
Heck no, because I could do white hair.
Amen.
No, but what it is that the State Board of California, when it comes to hair, the cosmetology, you only train, even if you go to a black beauty college, you only train for white hair. You don't train for doing black hair because they don't have that in the in cosmetology. The white kids don't have to do black hair. They only have to do white hair, but we have to do both. In other words, we press and curl hair before perms came out, the straightener hair. We would press it. They didn't teach that in white schools. They didn't have it at the State Board of Cosmetology. They didn't have that. But they taught it in black beauty colleges to do that.
Did you have any resistance by directors or even the actors themselves?
Actually, the actors were fine. But you've got to remember, when I came in, women did hair and men did makeup. There were no women doing makeup and there were no men doing hair. I was the first black hairstylist to ever get into the union.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So I had an incident with one actress, and she was a star. We don't know, one of the old stars. And she had never seen a male hairstylist.
Can you tell us who the star was?
Joan Blondell. So it's changing now because the more and more black actors and actresses, so you have to give it the time if you want the job.
Right. Cheryl, you were a set decorator, and we're talking obviously about Hollywood, but not all movies or TV shows are filmed on sets here in L.A. I mean, we're talking late 60s, early 70s. Only 5 or 6 years after the Civil Rights Act, you had to go to places that maybe weren't friendly.
I did. I also want to say that I think what's a little bit easier for me than Norm or Robert, because I'm a woman. And at the time, I think there were only men as set decorators. Now there's a lot more women. And even though there's a lot more women right now, I think there is only one black set decorator, and I'm not sure if she's in the union. Things are changing, but they're not changing as fast as they should. Robert said it took him 2 or 3 years to get into the union. It took me over a year and a half because they didn't know where to place me. But I had problems. I went on location all the time, and I was in one location in Galveston, Texas, and the producer took a group of us to dinner, I think it was. It was a lunch or dinner. And they wouldn't serve me. And they told him, said, we can't serve her in here. So, we all left and went to another restaurant. But, that probably happens now, too. It just depends on how far in the backwoods that you are. So,
matter of fact, to add to that, I was working in Glendale. I was working in Glendale, and the drivers drew me a map and said, you follow this route because we'll have guys coming down there. So don't very often go any other way, because if you get in any kind of hassle, we can help you.
Glendale, California.
This is Glendale, and this is in the 70s.
Yeah. I had always heard things about Glendale. It's changed now. But when they built the Americana, they always told me, said, be careful how you drive here to the Americana.
Right. Yeah, you didn't have to go to the South.
That's right.
Yeah. And, I wonder, Norm, what you just heard from Cheryl and what you heard from Robert, are things changing? You heard Cheryl say maybe not fast enough. What do you think?
That's the key word, not fast enough, because I worked 38 years. I've been retired 12 years. That's 50 years. And we're discussing the same issue as when I got in back in 1971. Matter of fact, it's probably worse. I asked my union, which was Local 600, how diverse were the people in the industry right now, just about 2 months ago, and they couldn't tell me. And I asked them point blank. I said, is it 10%? They couldn't answer. I said, I bet you it's not even 5%. And I said, I bet you it's not even 1%. And they didn't deny any of those claims. So I would say then we've got a long way to go. Long, long way to go.
Are y'all hopeful? Cheryl, are you hopeful?
I belong to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and they have just come up with this new idea that films have to have so many percent of minorities, of, all these different rules. So, therefore, a person as a producer making a film, they have to come to these standards, or else I think they're not going to be able to be up for Academy Award consideration. So that is a start right there. But if nobody forces them to do it, it's still going to be the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I want to end with you guys talking about, you know, the hopefulness of it, like maybe something will change. It seems like, you know, we've come at least some way, right, since Hattie McDaniel, right, couldn't sit in the coconut grove to accept her Oscar.
There were no black directors. Now you have a few black directors.
Yeah.
Black producers, black writers. You didn't have any of that stuff. I mean, it's changing a lot, but like we say, not fast enough.
I want to thank all of you. What a conversation, I tell you. Robert Stevenson, Cheryl Kearney, and Norm Langley, thank you, all three of you, for joining us today, and we'd love to have you back to talk more about it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Finally, in case you haven't gotten the memo, the email or Facebook reminder, today is Earth Day on a planet that's in trouble. One Angelino, whose name you probably know, wants you to hear it. You know the name Lucy Jones because when there's an earthquake in California, and by the way, there are a lot of earthquakes in California, people scramble to talk to her, interview her, seek her expertise. But in addition to being a scientist, she's also a musician. And she wrote a song to synthesize the data of climate change going back nearly a century and a half. Lucy Jones has a PhD in geophysics. She's LA's most famous seismologist, and she wrote the book The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. Welcome back, Lucy Jones.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You spend a lot of your time thinking about earthquakes. We spend a lot of our time thinking about you when we're thinking about earthquakes. But in terms of, you know, the bigger fish to fry, I mean, what should you be more afraid of, earthquakes or climate change?
Absolutely climate change. I've reached the point where I say I can't advocate any extra investment in seismic resilience if we aren't going to deal with climate change, because it's going to wipe us out potentially before many of the earthquakes happen.
Really? Wipe us out?
Well, it could. If we really do nothing about it, we are creating a situation where a large part of the world will become unfarmable. That's, you know, we think sea level rise only applies to those people out there. Think about the wildfires that are coming through California. Now let's make that 10 times worse as we continue to overheat the planet and have an ecosystem that's no longer matching the climate that it's receiving and has to change. And wildfires are the way they change. I don't think people understand the personal consequence well enough. And that's part of how I got into writing this music. I wanted to share my scientific understanding of climate change with the people I'm already sharing my music with, the people I play with.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, and just understanding that it really is going up, and it's going up faster. And when you hear it, sometimes you can process that in a different way.
Well, let's hear that, because you play the viola da gamba, by the way. And what is right. So interesting is that because you actually, in this piece, you chronicle climate change over the course of 140 years. And it's not until the latter part of this composition that we hear, and I want to hear some of this music now, because we're at the latter part of the composition now, where things are really starting to happen. And if you wouldn't mind, Lucy, you know, sort of talk us through this. What are we listening to right now? Let's hear it.
I have one instrument that plays the temperature data with a whole note for each year. And so as we go through, we have the early years where it's, you know, somewhat cooler and gradual shifting a little bit around. And as we keep on going forward through time, it's gradually getting higher. And in the first 10 decades, it'll go up, come back a little bit farther, a little bit back.
Wow.
But as we get towards the latter point, and as we're just starting to get into it here, the temperature's continuing to go up and we stop going down. And so the instrument that's playing the data was in the bottom part of the composition in the early part and is now moving farther on up.
Yeah, I hear the temperature rising.
You really do. And there's this normal pattern that was there earlier and how it's accelerating now. And here.
There it is.
Yeah. And we're now reaching up where it's going to literally be the top of the composition.
Oh, wow. Whew.
I did choose to take everybody to the same high note at the end with no harmonies left, to say it's an uncertain future. When I'd originally written it, I'd sort of helped it resolve and turned it into a major chord. And it's like, isn't that too optimistic? But I didn't want to be too pessimistic. And so I just left it open. We don't know where we're going.
Right. We don't know where we're going, right? We don't know, because we don't know how humans are going to respond to this.
Yeah. And I wrote this in the last administration where we weren't talking about climate change. At least we're talking about it again, but we're running out of time. And it will only get worse if we don't deal with it now.
And worse in LA, worse in California is hotter, maybe drier or more extreme, at least more wildfires.
Right. We definitely more wildfires, definitely hotter. I saw one, what they call a downscaling model, where they try and take the global climate model and look at what happens locally. And it said an increase in the number of extreme heat days above 90 degrees, an extra 60 per year, two more months of extreme heat.
Yeah.
And, but also the water, you know, we actually, it's one of the harder things to model, and it's not completely clear cut. Most likely the total amount of water will be the same, but it'll come in more extreme events. We'll have longer droughts and bigger storms, and we won't have the Sierra snowpack to reserve our water and help us manage it. So our water, feeding the human need for water is going to be much, much more difficult.
Do you think music, Lucy, is a way to spread this message? I mean, you did this obviously to articulate it, in an audio way. Have us listen to this, to the ramping up of climate change. So is that the way to get the point across?
I think so. It's funny. I wrote this originally for myself. It took me years before I started talking about sharing it with other musicians. I didn't expect it to have much popular appeal, but music taps into emotions. And one of our problems is if you look at how we process risk. So I saw this from the earthquake point of view. Everybody's really scared of earthquakes, even though it's far more dangerous to get on the freeway. And it's because they're sudden. They seem not understood. There's all these emotional factors that make them seem more dangerous. And the same emotional factors make climate change seem not as dangerous as it really is. It's taking so long. The scientists can tell us what's going on. It seems like it's understood. And if it's understood, it's not as scary, which is only true if we actually use that information to deal with it. And so we have the wrong emotional response to climate change. We need to be more frightened of it. And if we just feel sad about it, that's a disempowering emotion. We need to feel angry about it. We need to feel pride in addressing it, where we can be proud of how we fixed it instead of just despair at what can I do. And so it's an emotional change that we need in our society to really deal with climate change. And what is music but a way to inspire emotion?
Dr. Lucy Jones, Lucy, happy Earth Day to you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me and for being willing to talk about climate change and not earthquakes.
That's going to do it for us today. Boy, we don't like talking about earthquakes, but they do happen here in California. Next week, our series on the history of names in L.A. streets. Who was Henry Gaylord Wilshire, and why'd they name a boulevard after him? Catch us online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Any episode up to this one, there at the website. Subscribe to the podcast so you don't have to go searching anymore and have it delivered to kcrw.com/greaterLA or wherever you get your podcasts. Jenna Cagle, Camilla Thurdicuz, Sonia Geis, Kat Yore, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, and Christian Bordahl all made this evening's show happen. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your ears and for your time. Have yourself a great Thursday night.